This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kuser. Affordable housing. It was a contentious issue during this year's legislative session in Connecticut. Lawmakers considered a number of bills that could potentially transform how new affordable housing units are developed in the state. So, which of those bills survived the legislative process and became law? WSHU reporter Davis Donovan has kept an eye on the bills and the process, and he joins us now in the studio for a new change. Davis, hello and welcome.
Hi, thanks. It's good to be back in the studio.
There was one state bill that would affect local zoning rules, which drew quite a bit of attention. I believe that was HB, or House Bill 6107, designed to amend an existing law, the Zoning Enabling Act. Its purpose was to provide more affordable housing and to desegregate as well. Could you sort of give us an overview of what was in that bill?
Sure. As you said, the existing law, the Zoning Enabling Act, the original zoning laws of Connecticut are about a century old. And the idea that this bill's proponents had was kind of make them more equitable and more fitting for the 21st century. So it's a lot of things. There wasn't just any one particular overall fix. Accessory dwelling units was one of the major components of this. And accessory dwelling units, the term that a lot of people just use is granny pods. So think of a house with a little room above it, kind of at the top. That's a granny pod. I lived in one in college. And they're kind of hard to find in a lot of Connecticut towns. The official definition of a granny pod is it makes up 30% or less of a house. So this would have the goal of the proponents of the bill was to make accessory dwelling units, granny pods, more widely available. It also changes requirements for parking, and this one's a little complicated.
And when you say they're hard to find currently, mm-hmm. you mean they're just not allowed, or the ones that are existing were, excuse the term, grandfathered into zoning law?
Right. Well, towns can set their own standards for them, for how many they want to have. This bill would make it, the original version of the bill, the original vision they had was to require towns to have a certain number of them. That's changed a little bit, and we can talk about that. But
there was, now you mentioned the original version of mm-hmm. the bill. There was a rather, I think, infamous 24-hour hearing on this bill. Isn't that the case? There was quite a bit of uproar over it I'm not sure. Took the proposers by surprise.
Yeah, it was 23 hours and 50 seconds long, exactly 10 seconds short of being a full 24-hour hearing. Hundreds of people testified, and they didn't even get through everyone who wanted to testify. It kicked up a lot of anger. You can watch it on CTN, there's arguing not just between the people who are testifying, but I mean between the lawmakers as well. So there was a group formed to, the group that kind of put together a lot of these recommendations is called Desegregate CT. And then there's a group formed in opposition to them as well, which is called CT 169 Strong. So if you watch the hearing, a lot of the people who are talking are from one of those two groups, and they're butting heads constantly for 24 hours. CT 169 Strong held rallies throughout the state in different small towns where they kind of brought together people who were opponents of this and had them speak often in kind of like the little town greens under the gazebos to really emphasize what they said was going to destroy a lot of the flavor of small town Connecticut.
So there was quite a bit of opposition, quite a bit of support for that original bill. Let's talk about what actually passed. Mm-hmm. We talked a bit about the granny pods, the in-law apartment type situation that was adopted, but with a caveat.
Right. So the caveat here is that if a town wants to opt out of this, they can. There's a process they have to go about to do that.
So how does that make things different from the time when there wasn't a bill that allowed these? If the town can opt out, if they could have opted in, if they opted in, they could have done that before the bill was made law.
Right. Well, proponents of the bill say, and opponents of the bill complain, that the process to opt out is very difficult. You have to go through, you have to have two-thirds of the zoning board support the opt-out, and you have to have two-thirds of whatever governing body rules the town. That's often like a board of selectmen or a town council or something like that. So they say it's actually really difficult to get around this this hurdle.
Another provision had to do with how many parking spaces a new home or apartment can have. Again, the opt-out option is available to towns and cities that don't want to go along with this.
Right. The thing with parking is cities and towns can't require, under this law, for more than one parking space to be required for a studio or a one-bedroom apartment. So if you live in a studio, live in a one-bedroom, you have a right to one parking space, and that's it. And actually, the average in Connecticut is 1.73 parking spaces per. Which obviously, that's you're averaging there. You don't get three quarters of a parking space. But it's the same process. You have to if you want to opt out of this and have more than one parking space per resident, you have to go through a process, and that process involves both the zoning board and the town government.
You touched on this a moment ago. Back in April, also. I spoke with you and our colleague Janice Roman about your team reporting on this issue, on zoning issues when it comes to affordable housing. And one specific concern that you addressed was the desire of many residents to preserve what they call the character of the small towns in which they live. Character meaning?
Well, it means something different depending who you ask. Mm. And that's what made it such a controversial term. So if you talk to people in small towns, they'll say the character is a sort of an immutable term. You can't really put a definition on it. That just means the personality of the town. So if you go to like a small town in Connecticut, you see stone walls and little creeks and trees and little shops and things like that. But opponents say it's got connotations beyond that. So they say the term has racial implications. It's been used to keep people of color from getting access to these towns. One example of this, if the character of your town means that every house needs to have a certain amount of property, which is true of a lot of towns in Connecticut, you have to have a minimum of 1 acre or 2 acres. Well, who can afford to live on 1 or 2 acres? It's inherently excluding large numbers of people who don't have access to the character of the town. So the new law itself addresses the term character, and it changes the definition of character to be specifically physical site characteristics. So the word physical is kind of really key there, right? Not having anything to do with people, only having to do with the physical nature of the town, and that a project can't be denied unless the character is expressly articulated in regulations. In other words, if you care about character in your town, you have to have a definition for what it is. You can't just say, our character is our character. It can't be immutable anymore.
So perception sort of goes away when it comes to character definition.
Right, right. It becomes something that you have to codify and put in law, and it has to become objective.
So I guess this leads to this question. Does the new law achieve the goals of the original bill? You've been following this. You mentioned the two organizations that were pretty much in the lead in expressing both support for the bill, opposition to the bill. Did they all get what they wanted? Was this a compromise? Where does this bill leave affordable housing when it comes to zoning?
Right. Well, as is often not surprising with a lot of bills, nobody got everything they wanted. The bill, certain things were stripped out of the bill as it went through, and neither side really declared defeat, so to speak. But I think advocates certainly seemed happy about this, with a few caveats we've talked about. I think many of them would say, though, you know, this doesn't solve the problem. Now it becomes a stepping stone where we move forward from here into where they move forward from here into more maybe future bills that can address this. I think the people who oppose the bill also now see it as a stepping stone, but in the wrong direction. Right now, it's a move toward more state government encroachment in their local way of life. And they're afraid that they're going to see more bills in the future. So I think it followed. You know, if you think that the job of government is to compromise everything and comfort, then I think it did its job. Right. I think neither side was really 100% happy, but neither side declared defeat. It's as to how much this stepping stone changes things, you know, I think we'll see. Time will tell.
WSHU's Davis Donovan. Davis, thanks for bringing us up to speed on what's in the new zoning bill when it comes to affordable housing. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
Today, we're following up on the passage of a new zoning law in Connecticut that's intended to increase the number of affordable and modest housing units in the state. Back in April, we spoke with residents who supported and opposed the bill, and we're speaking with them again today. Joining me now on the phone is Sarah Bronin. She's the founder and lead organizer of Desegregate Connecticut, Desegregate CT. She is also an attorney and an architect. Ms. Bronin, welcome back to The Full Story.
Thanks for having me.
Certainly. If you could, please remind us, for those who are not familiar, about your group, Desegregate CT.
Yes, we are a group of 70-plus nonprofit organizations, a coalition involving housing, environmental, economic development, and other groups who have come together because we thought this year we could maybe get some zoning reforms over to the finish line.
And did the group, the larger group, Desegregate CT, come together specifically in response to the desires to change some zoning laws around the state?
Yes. We started last summer, and we really viewed this effort as being part of an overall push in our society to try to address some of the things that have locked structural racism in place. With zoning, you not only see that, but you also see an opportunity to improve the way that we develop land from an environmental perspective and also jumpstart the economy to more permissive building standards.
So Public Act 21-29, also known as, which the governor signed, also known as HB 6107, that's now law. It updates the state's Zoning Enabling Act, but it didn't come out of the legislature the same way that it went in. Does the version of the bill that was signed into law, that the governor put his signature on, does that square with what Desegregate CT wanted passed?
Well, first, I should say we are really thrilled that so many of our proposals did make it over the finish line this legislative session. A couple of them didn't, but we'll be back to talk about those. But the ones that did were really important. So you've probably heard, and I know we talked last time about accessory dwelling units, mm-hmm. And that is now legal in Connecticut, or when the law goes into effect, it will be. Towns do have an opportunity to opt out, but it's difficult to do so because it requires a two-thirds vote of both the zoning commission and the legislative body in the town. We also had proposed caps on minimum parking requirements. That also made it through with an opt-out. So those are the two provisions where they made it through, but it was different than what we had hoped. Nonetheless, we will still work to try to convince towns not to opt out and trying to show them why these were important. There were also a number of broader provisions that were included in the final language. One of them made the requirement that zoning regulations affirmatively further the purposes of the Fair Housing Act. This is makes Connecticut the first state to do that. And what that really goes to is really the heart of the issue, which is that many zoning regulations are one size fits all. By having that phrase in there and by ensuring zoning regulations promote more diverse housing, we think that that will help to move towns in the direction of reforming their overall zoning regulations to include and enable housing for a wider range of people.
Were there any provisions left out that Desegregate CT wanted included that, as you mentioned, you may be coming back to the legislature next session, next year, to work on?
There were two that we really thought should go this year, and we're hoping to review them and continue to build consensus for them for next year. What is the provision that we had that would have enabled more housing to be created around train stations? We think that that's sensible. We did polls showing that the vast majority of Connecticut residents think that that's smart policy. It helps to boost the state's investment that they make, the state's made in those train stations. And it also is sensible from an environmental perspective, because if you build housing around transit nodes, people will be less likely to use their cars, and they won't be living in sprawling, out-of-the-way developments that we know ruin our farmland and our forest. The other provision that we had hoped went this year was a provision about main streets and housing around our main streets. Historically, main streets were built with housing, and that's what made them vibrant. I mean, I'm talking small towns, larger cities. Unfortunately, we kind of reversed that in the 20th century, because a lot of towns prohibit housing from being located in coordination with retail along places where you have stores and shops and restaurants, and that actually hurts those small businesses. So again, from the perspective of trying to create alternatives to a car-oriented, one-size-fits-all zoning that we have in Connecticut, trying to enable more diverse housing than we have, trying to ensure that people who are older can walk to places, people with young families can do the same thing, and providing entry-level housing. We think that the Main Street provision is really a triple win, and so we're hoping that lawmakers do look at that in the next session.
Are there any new bills that your group is working on for the next session, in addition to revisiting some of the provisions that didn't make it through the last session?
Well, we're an organization that thrives on consensus, so we are talking with our coalition members about some of the additional information that we collected through our zoning atlas, which is on our website, desegregatect.org, which shows exactly how we zoned. Now, we didn't have all of the information that we have in the zoning atlas at the beginning of the last legislative session. We were collecting it as the legislation went on. Now we know, though, how different towns zone. And with that information, we're hoping to generate a few more proposals that we may be advocating for as the next legislative session comes around, or, by the way, at the local level, where we think that we can also continue to make changes within local governments and in planning and zoning commissions across the state. We've seen a lot of interest in moving and modernizing zoning regulations, so we're really looking forward to continuing that conversation with all of our partners representing all of the state.
It certainly sounds like you're invested in working with Desegregate CT well into the future, but I need to ask you this. You've been nominated by the Biden administration to lead the U.S. Advisory Council on Historic Preservation. First of all, congratulations on the nomination.
Thank you.
If you do get approved for the position, will that affect your work with Desegregate CT? Will you continue in the position that you're in right now?
Well, the great thing about what we've built over the last year is that there are dozens of volunteers that have worked with me side by side, putting in long hours, developing the strategy, and moving the organization forward, as well as our 70 coalition members. So one person is not the make or break for this movement, for this conversation. I hope to continue to support this effort in any way that I can. And if I am lucky enough to be confirmed by the Senate in the coming months, then I will follow all the appropriate rules that I'm supposed to in terms of formal involvement. But as I said, I'm not worried about this conversation continuing, because there are so many incredible people, many of them young people, who have stepped forward to become leaders in their community, leaders in this movement, and I predict will move us forward as a state in the coming years, decades, and beyond.
Ms. Bronin, again, congratulations on the nomination, and thank you for your time today, bringing us up to date on what's happening with Desegregate CT. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Sarah Bronin is the founder and lead organizer of Desegregate CT. Joining me now via Skype is Alexis Harrison of Fairfield and a member of CT 169 Strong, a group opposed to state-mandated changes to local zoning laws. Ms. Harrison, thanks so much for coming back to the full story with us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Oh, certainly. For those who don't know, could you please remind us why CT 169 Strong was organized to begin with?
Sure. We organized earlier in 2020 because we heard that there was going to be a lot of zoning proposals on the table with the legislator. And that concerned us as a group composed of, you know, various people from across Connecticut who are really worried about losing something that we really value in Connecticut, which is home rule. So we turned our attention to really educating the public about the various zoning bills that were in front of the legislator in the past session.
So part of it was the fact that these were state bills, state legislature bills that would have been essentially trying to control local zoning rules.
And you know, in Connecticut, we have 169 cities and towns. And unlike, you know, a lot of states, we don't have county government. So local rule is really important to Connecticut people. And we don't believe in, you know, big government. So that's why we got involved.
HB 6107 was the bill we talked about when we last spoke. It was in committee at the time, I believe. And that's the bill that eventually made its way to the governor's desk, although it was changed significantly from some of the original ideas that were in it. Does the new law, the way it got to the governor's desk and was signed, did that address the concerns that you had about the original bill?
Yeah, it definitely addressed some of the concerns that we had. It's certainly a more watered-down bill, if you will. In 6107, as you said, was passed by Governor Lamont. But it, you know what, I believe it really opens the door for future encroachment on home rule. This is just kind of one step getting there. Every Republican in the House voting opposed the measure, as well as 8 Democrats. And we just believe, you know, centralized power by Hartford will be attempted by future legislators in the coming year or two.
You mentioned some of it was watered down. Could you be more specific? Were there elements that were either removed or the impact lessened that you were happy to see?
Yeah, I mean, certainly. So, you know, some major things that came out of this bill, what it removes the word character from the Zoning Enabling Act, which is Section 8.2 of our general statutes, and replaced with physical site characteristics instead. I personally don't have an issue with that. There's also now a working group, and they are charged with putting together a fair share study. This working group will be, you know, various people from, you know, the Democrats caucus, from the Republican caucus, and other, you know, groups. So that's something that we're watching. In addition, it does allow accessory dwelling units to be built on properties as well. But one issue I have with that, it doesn't really allow for a public zoning take place for that dwelling. So something will be built on somebody's, you know, property without, you know, much oversight. So that's concerning. And I don't know how that really brings more affordable housing to towns. I don't know how many people will actually participate with that. But I think we have to remember what thing is really missing here is the fact 830G, which is the affordable housing law in Connecticut, has not been addressed. There are many shortcomings with that bill. It allows many developers to build inappropriate buildings in the wrong location. And I think those shortcomings should really be addressed by this working group, and I hope they are.
That's the bill that's already in existence that's been around for quite some time, correct?
Yes, it's been around 30 years, correct.
The new bill, what impact do you think it could have on a town like Fairfield? Is there something in it? You mentioned that it is watered down. However, it could be a stepping stone to other amendments or other new legislation that would deal with local zoning laws. What kind of an impact do you think this kind of a law could have on a town like Fairfield?
I mean, I think, well, for one, there are parking restrictions. That's another part of the bill. It sets limits on the number of parking spaces that can be required when you build something. That would have an impact on any municipality, including Fairfield. There are a municipal opt-out provision for that accessory dwelling unit, which is good, but I think it would take a lot for a town to have to do that. In addition, I think there's a clause in here about the sewer measures. The Department of Public Health would have to oversee alternative systems of up to 5,000 gallons per day, and that's quite a bit. So I think that would be a big stress on any municipality. you know, all these laws have impact on our local towns, and it's, and I find it unfortunate that a lot of the concerns of various mayors and first select people across Connecticut of all political stripes were just not heard during the session.
Are your members reporting any action that's being taken in the wake of this law being being signed? It may be too soon to tell, but have you seen any developments on the table or moved along in the past couple of days?
I have not, actually, but that's something we'll definitely be, you know, monitoring, you know, this summer and as we go into the fall.
One of the parts of the bill that seem to favor your position to some extent is the opt-out provision, where certain kinds of development can be opposed or can be put off the table by local communities, given a certain amount of support from members of that community.
Yeah, that's definitely, you know, a small victory for municipalities. The bill includes an opt-out provision, as you said, for accessory dwelling apartments. I think that's line 429447, mm-hmm. and parking requirements, which is line 337. So yes, a municipality zoning commission and its legislative body, whether that's an RTM or a city council, can opt out if they have a 2/3 vote. But it would depend if they have the numbers to opt out.
I was going to say a 2/3 vote. That can be a pretty high threshold to meet.
Yeah, this threshold may not. It's a high bar for some municipalities that, you know, may not be able to get locally 2/3 of whatever party on their side. So, yeah, it could be an uphill battle.
You mentioned this earlier on. I gather, though, that CT 169 Strong will not be disbanding in the wake of the governor signing this particular bill, which, again, was somewhat of a compromise between those who opposed it and those who were in favor of it. You'll be continuing your work?
Absolutely. We are not slowing down at all. You know, what we really want to strive for and really want to work with people, lawmakers of all political sides, is really create, you know, bills, laws that create affordable housing in Connecticut and address the real problems here. You know, 6107 does not address affordability. Doesn't even mention really affordability. So I think we really need to work hard at collectively as a state with all stakeholders to put together legislation that helps people who need it.
Ms. Harrison, thanks so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
Alexis Harrison is a member of CT 169 Strong. We'll talk next about people who could lose their homes in Connecticut because the state moratorium on evictions, prompted by loss of work and income during the pandemic, ended this week. But wait, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has extended the federal moratorium through July. To better understand how these two facts square and to find out if Connecticut's prepared to help potentially thousands of people facing eviction, we've asked the executive director of the Connecticut Fair Housing Center, Erin Kempel, to join us, which she has done via phone. Ms. Kempel, hello, and welcome to The Full Story.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for having me.
Certainly. The Connecticut Fair Housing Center, for those who don't know, please remind us about the work that you do.
We are a statewide nonprofit that focuses on housing discrimination, foreclosure prevention, and eviction prevention.
Now, some say that the pandemic is waning and some rules and regulations have been relaxed with that in mind. But even if that's true, your workload at the center, that is not lessening at this point, I would imagine.
That's absolutely true. I was just looking at some data before we spoke, and there's still 130,000 tenants in Connecticut who have stated that they are not caught up on rent. And that information comes from the Household Pulse Survey, which is done every 2 weeks by the U.S. Census.
And those numbers, those people, are they scattered evenly throughout the state, or are there concentrations in certain areas?
Well, there are concentrations in terms of people of color. So of the people who are not caught up on rent, 36% of them are Latino, 41% are Black, 16% are people of two or more races, and only 8% are people who are white. So one of the things that got the Fair Housing Center into doing eviction work during the pandemic was its outsized impact on people of color. And in addition to that, Connecticut is very segregated, with 8% of Connecticut's municipalities housing 69% of people of color. So when we're talking geography, we know that the cities of Waterbury, Bridgeport, Stamford, New Haven, New London, Hartford, are all going to bear the brunt of people being evicted.
Did the pandemic aggravate those differences?
Absolutely. While we have always had an affordability issue in Connecticut, the people of color in Connecticut lost their jobs at higher rates than people who are white, making it much more difficult for them to pay rent, even if they could afford the rent before the pandemic began.
In order to help people who need the kind of outreach that you provide, given the changes the pandemic has created, is the way you operate any different than the way you operated pre-pandemic?
In June of 2020, when the staff of the center saw the impact of the virus and the pandemic and economic shutdown on people and communities of color, the staff of the Connecticut Fair Housing Center asked its board of directors if we could spend our own money in order to be able to create an eviction prevention project, which they did. And we have hired two people to work on that. As a result of that work, we have had a significant increase in the number of calls that we've been receiving and the number of people we've been able to help. But it's still very difficult because oftentimes the only help we can give is advice, because what people really need is money to pay the rent, and that's what they don't have.
I think it's potentially confusing, the information about the moratoriums. How should we understand the difference between the state and federal eviction moratoriums? As I mentioned earlier, and of course you know, the state eviction moratorium has expired, but the federal one has been extended through this month.
That's correct. So the federal moratorium is significantly different than the moratorium that just expired. And the reason for that is that the federal moratorium is not automatic. In order to be protected from eviction, a tenant must fill out a declaration form, which is an affidavit that has several specific elements that must be included. Things like, I certify that I have lost money from as a result of COVID-19, or I have applied for all of the emergency rental assistance that may be available. Once that declaration is filled out, the tenant must then give it to the landlord. It is then up to the landlord to decide if they're going to honor that. The law says that they have to honor it, but we're finding that a lot of landlords, even when they get the CDC moratorium, are still proceeding with eviction. If a tenant has a case in court, then they also have to give a copy of that declaration to the judge. And we're also finding that a lot of judges aren't honoring the CDC declarations, meaning that they're allowing evictions to go forward. So that is why in Connecticut, we have been fortunate to have an eviction moratorium, which just expired yesterday. The only good news is that Governor Lamont did do a couple of things that I think will help mitigate the effect of the moratorium expiring. And so one of the things that the governor did is to say that, or to issue an executive order that says that landlords must apply for UniteCT, the Emergency Rental Assistance Program, before they can give a notice to quit for non-payment of rent. So in normal times, or before the pandemic, the landlord was allowed to give a notice to quit anytime the tenant owed rent. Now the landlord cannot give a notice to quit for non-payment of rent until after they have applied for UniteCT and included that UniteCT case number on the notice to quit. In addition to that, landlords must give tenants a 30-day notice to quit. Prior to this, notices to quit could be much shorter than 30 days, but now in order to begin an eviction case, the notice to quit has to be 30 days. And in addition to that, the notice to quit has to have information about the UniteCT program included in it.
This is the kind of information that you offer as advice, I would assume, to tenants who are facing potential eviction, because it sounds like it can be a pretty cumbersome and certainly confusing when someone tries to wade through this.
It is very confusing, and one of the things that we always tell tenants is that they should apply for UniteCT even if the landlord has said he or she won't accept the money from the state. Unfortunately, one of the things that has happened is that landlords are not participating in the program at about almost three times the rate of tenants. So when you look at who has applied, either the landlord or the tenant can begin the process, and landlords have not responded to requests to participate at almost three times the rate of tenants.
Why do you think they would not want to be involved in the program?
One of the things that landlords have said to us and to our clients is that they believe that if they are able to evict the tenant, they will be able to rent the apartment at a much higher rate. So they think that by getting out a tenant who's paying $1,000 or $1,200 in rent, they will then be able to turn that over and start renting to someone who, I don't know, will pay $1,500 or $2,000. I don't know if that's actually true. Of course, we've all heard the stories of people, tenants, leaving New York City to move to Connecticut, but I don't know if that's still going on, if that's still happening in the high numbers that it was earlier in the pandemic. And in addition to that, landlords are still going to have a significant debt if they evict a tenant. You know, one thing that I have heard the sociologist Matt Desmond say several times is landlords don't walk out of a courthouse with a check in their hand if they evict a tenant. So it's not clear to me why it makes economic sense to evict someone when you could get up to $15,000 in a rental arrearage paid by the state of Connecticut.
I'm speaking with Erin Kempel, the executive director of the Connecticut Fair Housing Center. Ms. Kempel, back in January, you said your organization was seeing a threefold increase in calls for help compared to January of 2020, these calls coming from people who were seeking your help. I'm wondering, given that now the Connecticut moratorium's expired, the federal one extended, but only for another few weeks, really, are you still seeing that big jump in calls for help?
We certainly are. When I spoke with you in January, the pandemic was 9 months old. We're now into almost the 16th month of the pandemic, and you said at the top of our discussion that things are getting better, but they are not getting better for everyone. And in particular, poor people of color are still being overwhelmingly affected by the pandemic and the economic shutdown that happened as a result of that. So we continue to have high numbers of calls. We continue to refer people to all of the resources that are out there, UniteCT and other programs that may be able to assist tenants, but it's still a very difficult situation. And if you look at what has happened in other states, they have had in the state of Delaware, I think they had 1,000% increase in the number of eviction filings once the eviction moratorium was lifted in that state.
You had said at one point that also evicting someone from their homes increases the chances of their getting infected or infecting others with COVID-19, with the coronavirus. Is there less support for keeping the moratorium in place now that you think with so many people being vaccinated? And I guess we should bring into the discussion here, too, the potential that the Delta variant could cause a bit of a resurgence in some areas.
So a recent study that was put out by the Eviction Lab at Princeton University shows that neighborhoods with the highest eviction rates have the lowest levels of COVID-19 vaccinations. As a result of that, evictions will result in spreading the virus because once people are physically removed from their homes, they will be either doubling or tripling up with family or friends or moving into a shelter, and as a result of that are likely either to spread the virus if they're carrying it or get it from other people. The other thing that the Eviction Lab has found is that women who are evicted from their homes during their pregnancies have a higher likelihood of premature birth, babies with low birth weight, as well as higher infant mortality. So it's really not just a question of the coronavirus, although that is very serious, but it has other health consequences and certainly educational consequences as well.
It can all sound very discouraging, unfortunately. On the positive side, I'm assuming this is something on the positive side. This month, Governor Lamont signed legislation that will ensure low-income tenants will have access to an attorney should they face eviction. What do you think about this new law? Is it a significant help for tenants?
It will be a significant help for tenants in the long run. Other communities, the New York City, Cleveland, Ohio, and a couple of other places around the country that have implemented a right to counsel for tenants in eviction have seen significant savings in across the board in terms of expenditure on social services, homelessness, homeless shelters, et cetera. And so we think it is going to be a game changer in the long run. Unfortunately, the program isn't going to be able to open before October 1st because of just the difficulties that there are in setting up the program and hiring the people for it. So we are extremely excited. We think right now only 7% of tenants in eviction cases have attorneys, and as opposed to 80% of landlords. And so we think that this really will make a huge difference. I just wish we had had it sooner so that we could have moved all of this forward at the time when it's particularly needed as a result of the pandemic.
You had mentioned before there are 130,000 people behind in their rent in Connecticut at the moment. I'm wondering, too, what about homeowners who have fallen behind on their mortgages? Are they at risk of losing their homes through foreclosure and eviction?
So the number of people who are behind on the mortgage is not as high. And part of that is that for people who are lower income, the forbearance agreements are still in effect and will continue to be in effect for several additional months. So they would not necessarily be reporting as being behind on the mortgage. However, of the people who are reporting that they're behind on the mortgage, 23% of Black homeowners and 27% of people of two or more races are not caught up on their mortgage payments compared to 3% of White homeowners. So again, we're seeing the very disparate impact on people of color in their ability to keep their homes. The state of Connecticut, as a result of the American Rescue Plan money that it received, will be creating a housing assistance program for homeowners in who are not fully caught up on their mortgages. We were hoping it would go into effect in July, but it has not. We've not yet gotten any word as to exactly when that program will start.
We've talked about the governor signing legislation that gives people facing eviction an attorney to work with and a couple of other options for getting help. Are there policies you'd like to see put in place to help people keep their homes or get rehoused quickly?
Well, I think that the governor has taken an important step by making by requiring landlords to apply for UniteCT before they can bring an eviction action for non-payment of rent. It's something that we have asked for, housing advocates have asked for, almost since the beginning of the pandemic, when the original emergency rental assistance program started in July of 2020. So I think that's a good step. I wish that the program that the moratorium would have been extended, because one of the things that we're seeing is that the UniteCT program is increasing the number of people who are approved and paid at a much quicker rate than when it began in March of 2015, in March of 2021. So we think that had the eviction moratorium been extended for a little bit longer, we think that it would have made a significant difference. The other thing that has been recommended is that the states create programs to divert people from eviction. So the Assistant Attorney General of the U.S., Gupta, had sent a letter to all of the judges and housing courts throughout the country, giving them several ideas on things to do. And the number one was diversion from eviction. We certainly have a diversion program from homelessness here in Connecticut, where if you're homeless or about to become homeless, there are several things that can be done to prevent you from going into a shelter, even if it's just temporary housing. I think additional efforts like that should be used, as well as vouchers that will actually pay rent for people who are unable to afford the rent.
For someone who is facing these problems personally, or perhaps knows someone who is in this kind of a dilemma, where should they go to get more information?
So the difficult part of UniteCT is that it is an application that has to be done online. So if you put UniteCT into a search engine, a computer search engine, or a smartphone search engine, you're going to get directed to the site. However, it is also possible to go to, if you don't have internet access, you don't have a computer, or your smartphone won't support the application, it is possible also to call, and I'm trying to find the number for you, so that you can go to a community agency that could help you fill out the application and figure out how to get everything in that is needed.
People can go to, if they're looking for basic initial information, they can go to your website, ctfairhousing.org,
yes,
to get started?
Yes. There are all kinds of fact sheets and FAQs there in several different languages, including Spanish. And there are also there is also a link to the UniteCT website. So all of those can get someone. And the number that someone could call in order to get referred to a community agency for help in filling out the application is 1-844-864-8328. And what they will ask is your address. Once they have your address, they will give you the name of a community agency that exists near you and can help you fill out an application.
Ms. Campbell, thank you so much for all of this information. We appreciate it.
All right. Thank you for calling.
Aaron Campbell is the executive director of the Connecticut Fair Housing Center. We turn our attention next to Long Island, where there also could be a flood of evictions to deal with. With me now is Ian Wilder, the executive director for Long Island Housing Services. His organization is a private nonprofit fair housing advocacy and enforcement agency, which serves both Suffolk and Nassau counties, and he joins us via Skype. Mr. Wilder, welcome back to The Full Story.
Thank you for having us.
Certainly. When we spoke back in January, you were somewhat frustrated with the federal government's management of their eviction moratoriums. You said they were delaying the problem, but also weren't coming up with a plan that could really help keep people keep their homes. We were planning to speak with you when the moratoriums expired, but as it turns out, as we mentioned earlier, the federal one extended now through July, and New York's extended the state deadline to August 31st. To your satisfaction, has the federal government, or New York State for that matter, addressed your concerns about putting a plan in place to help people keep their homes?
They started putting pieces of the plan in place. The problem is things are so recent that it's hard to tell. There's going to be some funding for homeowners under the Homeowner Affordability Fund, the HAF fund. Also, CDBG just yesterday put out some guidelines for servicers about what they're supposed to be doing. But it's hard to tell this early what all this means. What I don't see is, and maybe it's behind the scenes, is the kind of deep pressure that's needed to make sure that this moves in a direction that's useful. Too much was left in the hands of the banks and the services last time, and the process worked very poorly. I would hope to see still a lot more structure. And the funding I'm talking about is acknowledged to be insufficient to deal with the entire problem. So we are seeing some pieces being put in place, but I don't see the massive architecture that we're going to need to solve this problem.
More specifically, is there a way to measure success or at least progress when it comes to moving in the right direction, helping homeowners stay in their and renters stay in their homes? How would you gauge that? Or is it just too early to tell what a positive result would look like?
I think the simpler a program and the broader its reach and the more clarity about what resources are available for landlords and banks to resolve the issues would make it clear that there's actually going to be a resolution rather than the muddle that we ended up after the 2008 crisis.
The funding that you mentioned a moment ago, is that the federally funded $2 billion rent relief program that's in place in New York?
No, that's another program that is coming through.
That seems to be off to a rather rocky start, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's funny. I've long been an advocate for decentralization, but I'm really starting to believe that the federal government has a program, they should just put it in place. Mm. It doesn't make sense to be sprinkling the money all over the place and then have each little municipal piece have to figure out how to do it. It would just be easier. I mean, money is money is money. Money is the same in North Dakota as it is in New York. You know, landlords expect to be paid the same way. And regional setups for things like HUD, if there's some type of difference to deal with. But I'm really starting to believe that having it go down, some of this money, the ERAP program, I believe is what you're talking about. Mm. Some of this money goes down to the town level for them to put out to town residents. And it just doesn't make sense. You lose so much time. You spend so much duplication of funds. All these different people have to get up to speed. I would be much happier with national programs. Not that I'm a fan of doing things large scale, but the cost of doing it so local is not worth it to solve the problem.
At any level, national, local, or all the way down to the very, very small municipal level, are any programs that you've seen, any plans that you've seen, well-designed so the tenants and landlords can work together to resolve back rent problems?
All the information I have is based on stories we get. So I don't have hard data, but from talking to people on the ground, I haven't heard a program that I've gone, wow, that's great, that's perfect, that's going to get a lot of money out of the door quickly, or is getting a lot of money out of the door quickly. And to me, that should be the greatest value. Because, I mean, we have people on both ends of every problem. We have the tenants and the landlords who are both being hurt by this. And not only that, when you put money in the hands of people who are middle class or people who are poorer, they spend that money. It goes into the economy. It has a multiplying effect. So it benefits all of us. It also benefits all of us not to have people out in the street or suffering through the courts, or and losing work time. So it's a huge benefit. Efficiency is a huge benefit to all of us.
I'm speaking with Ian Wilder, the executive director for Long Island Housing. Again, back when we spoke in January, you said that renters and homeowners should get in touch with HUD counselors, housing counselors, to make a plan before the moratoriums end. They got extended. The national and New York ones were extended, but that's only by a month and 2 months. Are people doing this, first of all, to your knowledge, and are you still encouraging that to be the best route to solving their back rent problems?
I just want to take a second for one thing, because we have some similar named organizations on the island. So ours is Long Island Housing Services. It's a long name. It is the best route because housing counselors, like the ones that I work with, spend literally every day keeping up to date on what programs are available, especially because the programs are so location-based, town by town, county by county. They vary so much that hard for somebody who isn't paid to do this, you know, 8 hours a day to keep up and sort all this out. So housing counselors are the best thing. You can contact an agency like mine. You can just type in the Google housing counselor and wherever you live, for instance, Long Island, Connecticut, or you can go to HUD's website and they have a very easy search tool by state, and you can find somebody near you, and they are compensated by grants. So it is a no-cost solution for you to use people who have expertise in this, and this is what they do day in and day out.
What about the cancel rent movements in New York? Is that a viable solution to any of these problems?
It is. And I'll be honest, I haven't paid close enough attention. If we deal with the landlord end of it too, it's cancel rent means that to me at least, that everybody's rent is paid off. The problem is getting the funds, getting it to people. And I'll be honest, after the stimulus program, I wonder if we're better off having the equivalent of a stimulus check or universal basic income just out to everybody, because the costs of running these systems and checking people for eligibility, to me, seems to be much greater than the few people who get money who don't need it. Because most of us need it. So I'm just wondering if we should look at a different method of resolving this. Because that's the problem with all these rent programs. You have to spend a lot of time getting money into place and then determining who's eligible. And there are many barriers to it. For instance, out on Long Island, it's very common for properties where people live not to have permits because we have a dearth of rental housing. So those landlords really don't have an incentive to sign off on a government document saying I'm renting to somebody and potentially put themselves in legal jeopardy. Now, I'm not saying it's a good idea what they're doing. Some probably have health and safety problems, and that's why they're not permitted. Others are just looking to avoid taxes and other costs. So there are a lot of barriers to getting the money out to people, and that's the problem. Cancel rent, to me, just means get everybody's rent paid. The question is how to do that.
Sounds like a challenge to anyone listening to come up with, as you said, a new way, an innovative way of resolving this problem.
Yes, it is a challenge, which is why I really think we need to look at broader and different ways of doing this. because the ways in the past that are very, that require a lot of paperwork and a lot of time have not worked very well.
We will most likely be checking in with you again, Mr. Wilder, in about 6 months, just to see where this situation is once the moratoriums have ended and some time has passed. And we thank you again for being with us today and getting us up to speed on this. We appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for the time.
Ian Wilder is the executive director for Long Island Housing Services. What's your housing situation? And what do you think of the new zoning rules? Let us know. You can email us at tfs@wshu.org, and we're on Twitter at @FullStoryWSHU. That's it for our program today. Produced by Fatou Sangare and senior producer Ann Lopez. I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.